making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world on the web at Hewlett.org.
News from NPR is made possible by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. Programs on WILL are made possible by McKinley Presbyterian Church and Foundation, a welcoming faith community that fosters spiritual exploration and works for social change. McKinley is committed to inclusiveness and welcomes all. 5th and John Streets on campus, on the web at mckinley-church.org.
It's 6 minutes past 1 o'clock. Today, the afternoon magazine features an interview from the AM 580 archives. Since it's a recorded interview, we won't be taking phone calls this afternoon. This is the afternoon magazine from Illinois Public Media, AM 580, 90.9 FM, HD2, online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. When the war in Iraq began, photographer Barry Goldstein wondered, in an all-volunteer military, who steps forward and why? With those questions in mind, he set out to ask soldiers to tell their stories. He spent 2 years photographing and interviewing actively serving members of an armored battalion of the 3rd Brigade Combat Team. He says he set out with no political agenda, wanting the soldiers to speak for themselves. In his words, no one indicts war more powerfully than an experienced soldier, and no one enumerates more eloquently the reasons for serving. The stories and portraits of men and women soldiers ranking from specialist to command, sergeant, major, lieutenant through colonel are contained in the book Grayland, Soldiers on War. Barry Goldstein is our guest this afternoon. He is a professor at the University of Rochester and at New York University. He's also the author of Being There, Medical Student Morgue Volunteers Following 9/11. His new book, Grayland, Soldiers on War, is published by W.W. Norton, and you'll find him online at www.bgoldstein.net. Listeners, join the discussion with your questions and comments. I look forward to your telephone calls. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. Our toll-free number, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. Barry Goldstein, good afternoon. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, my pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Sure. Well, would you tell us, first of all, about what inspired the title for this book, Grayland?
It's a quote from a poem by Siegfried Sassoon called Dreamers, and it's some of your audience probably knows Siegfried Sassoon was a soldier in the First World War and survived and became a well-known poet. And the little section from the poem that really spoke to me reads, "Soldiers are citizens of death's gray land, drawing no dividend from time's tomorrows. In the great hour of destiny they stand, each with his feuds and jealousies and sorrows." And this spoke to me for two reasons. One, it really emphasizes something that I set out to do, which was to show that even though soldiers look the same, dress the same, they have the same haircuts and so on, they're not the same. They're drawn from every aspect of American society, and indeed have the same hopes, dreams, fears as the rest of us. And also the idea of a gray land really spoke to me in terms of my memories of Iraq, both being a sort of literally gray land, very dusty and where the colors have been leached out, and also gray metaphorically, with everyone under stress and strain. So that that was the reason that I chose that title.
Yeah. It also speaks to the gray area of in terms of ethical considerations and morality.
Interesting. Yeah, you're actually the first person to point that out. But very true.
Yeah. At the outset of the book, you say you're not a soldier, nor have you ever served. Mm-hmm. So what led you to ask those questions in an all-volunteer military? Who steps forward and why?
Well, I realized when we invaded Iraq that I was seeing pictures on TV and reading articles about all these people who we were sending overseas, and I just realized that here I was, supposedly good citizen, and how little I knew about who these people were and what they did, and at what cost to themselves and their families. And I wanted to find this out. That was one motivation. The other was I had just finished a project dealing with young people who had also been put under or in situations of great stress, and studied how they'd responded, and that was the Being There project that you had mentioned, which was looking at a group of young New York University medical students who had volunteered to work in medical examiners' morgues after 9/11. And many of these students were really traumatized. This, and I was struck by the analogies that I saw between the young medical student volunteers and the soldiers that I was seeing on TV and in the newspaper.
Mm. One of the soldiers that we find in Greyland, Soldiers on War, is a fellow by the name of Specialist Alexander Koch, and mm-hmm. he said, "The people back home, civilians, they can't possibly know what we have all been through together." He also told you that when he went home, he tried to leave Iraq in Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
What would someone like Specialist Koch like us to know about what war is like?
Boy. I think the first part of his statement that we don't have a clue is really accurate. I think there are many answers to that question. I think the first thing that he and many of the soldiers want to people to understand is that they're in a profession, and they take this profession very seriously, but that they don't get to decide where they're sent. All they can do is try to do the very best possible job that they can do once they're sent there. So that would be one thing about his job I think he would want us to understand. And then I think that most of these soldiers, certainly they all know and probably would like the public to have a better appreciation for the fact that war is, there's nothing glorious about war. There's nothing romantic about it. It's a very, very hard, challenging crucible. And although they're very well trained to deal with this, it takes its toll in both body and spirit. And I think they would appreciate or wish the public would appreciate just what some of this entails, again, both physically and mentally. That this is not a game. So I think some of those issues would be things that all the soldiers would like people to realize. And I would say the last thing that many of the soldiers said to me was, look, part of our job, as the Army says right up front, our job is to close with and destroy the enemy. And that's, of course, the part of the military that most people are familiar with. But almost to a man and a woman, many of the soldiers took great pains to point out some of what we might refer to as the more constructive aspects of their job, the civil engineering aspects, the educational aspects, and so on that they did. Many of these soldiers really were quite dedicated to improving the lives of the people in the areas in which they operated.
Yeah. The soldiers face a number of missions. This is something that you have written about in the introduction to Greyland. They serve as warriors, politicians, civil engineers, social workers, economists, mm-hmm. and whatever else is called for in their area of operations. How do they handle all those demands?
Your guess is as good as mine.
I've not served, and you have not served.
I'm sorry?
I said neither one of us have served.
You know, first off, they're extremely well-trained. This is something I think the public at large doesn't really appreciate, or I won't speak for the public. I'll speak for myself. I didn't appreciate this. Soldiers are highly trained and skilled in operating weapon systems and so on. But I don't want to say that's the least of it, but that's only part of the training. Perhaps a little anecdote would best illustrate this. I asked a young lieutenant if he had to, who was a West Point graduate, if he had to say anything or if he could say anything to his colleagues back at West Point, the students, what would it be? And he said the following. He said, you know, one of our standing orders is be polite, be professional, be polite, be prepared to kill. I think this little phrase has been heard in the media and so on, and it's very common in the Army. And he said, you know, being professional, that's not hard. That's what we're trained to do. We spend many years learning the craft. Be prepared to kill, well, that's part of the training. It's not easy, but it's something to do. But, you know, being polite is probably the most important thing, not only from a moral and social point of view, but from a tactical point of view as well. If we're polite to the civilians, they're more likely to share information with us. Our job is easier. And this takes a certain degree of flexibility and a certain degree of empathy, but it is very much worth it. And those units who take that lesson to heart suffer fewer casualties in their particular area. I think that sort of brings home the lesson that these soldiers are quite intelligent and quite aware of what their job calls for, and very flexible. Necessity is the mother of invention, and the training in the Army is accomplish the mission, but how one accomplishes the mission is, again, requires a certain degree of flexibility, and the Army is pretty good these days at instilling that.
Yeah. Also in Greyland, in terms of training, there are a number of photographs of the training the soldiers receive at Fort Irwin, California.
Mm-hmm.
And the training, it really looks like the real thing.
Yes, it's as close to being there as you can without anyone shooting at you, which, of course, is a big difference. But what they say is that each day at the NTC, the National Training Center at Fort Irwin, is supposed to simulate your worst day in Iraq. And so they have simulated Iraqi villages and Iraqi soldiers and simulated insurgents, all played by employees, many of whom are Iraqi Americans, and who are very familiar with the culture and politics there. A unit will be sent out perhaps to negotiate something with a local sheikh, and in the middle of those negotiations, an IED may go off and other things will happen, and the local commander is responsible for dealing with that. And the simulations are so realistic that they may even have a news person, say, there recording what's happening. And back at the command center, they may see the results of that operation on their simulated Al Jazeera with that particular SLAN. So the commanders have to deal with, you know, with all aspects of this. And, of course, as a visitor, it's great fun because they're going through the motions, but, of course, and taking it extremely seriously, and physically it's extremely demanding. But, again, there's no real danger.
Yeah. I wonder, of course, it's good to be trained and prepared, but I wonder if it heightens the anxiety before one heads out for a mission.
I think it's probably just the opposite. That is, it increases one's confidence that you are prepared to deal with any anything that arises. So I think the soldiers trust a great deal in their training, and I think rightfully so. I think that the training really does prepare them very well for dealing with these things. I, on the other hand, who have no training, which would have a very high level of anxiety going out on a mission.
Yeah.
So yes, I think training is very important in allowing soldiers to handle these incredible stresses, both physical and mental.
There's a photograph it comes at the close of your introduction to Greyland, and it is of a soldier who is on his way to Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
He's in a C-130.
Yes.
Would you describe that photograph for us and talk about how it was made and what you were thinking about what he was thinking at the time?
Yeah, as you mentioned, the photograph is taken in a C-130, which is sort of an extremely utilitarian transport used by the Army. It was taken during my second trip to Iraq on the way from Kuwait to Bayap, Baghdad International Airport. This was just prior to taking off from Kuwait, and of course the temperature was well over 100 degrees, and the soldier is sitting in front of the door, which is still open, trying to get a little bit of breeze, but he's wearing, I would guess, about 70 pounds of body armor and weaponry, and on his way to a not terribly pleasant place. This was a National Guard unit, so in fact some of the soldiers were a bit older. This fellow, who's a sergeant, is probably in his late 30s, early 40s, he's clearly already tired, and his ordeal hasn't even begun. And I saw this and was, of course, feeling a little bit of what he was feeling. So it really resonated with me, and I snapped this picture. I like the sort of combination of the sense of heat, exhaustion, and mental strain.
Yeah.
And the ubiquitous water bottle.
Yeah.
That's really a necessity. It's sort of like carrying oxygen and up at Everest. You don't want to get dehydrated. It can be quite dangerous.
The soldiers that you interviewed and photographed, what did they think of this project?
They were all incredibly supportive. Even soldiers who initially said, I don't want to be photographed, I don't want to be interviewed. When I explained to them, you know, what my intent was, that I wasn't out to prove a point or had any particular agenda, that I just wanted to convey to people like me what it was that they did, became quite enthusiastic about it. You know, I think everybody wants their story told, and this was certainly true of the soldiers, and they were extremely grateful that somebody was taking the time to do this, to even just to listen to them, because when I was doing the interviews and photographs, I had could not guarantee that this would be published, and I made that clear, as I do in all my projects. But that didn't matter, you know, just giving them the opportunity to talk to someone who was interested in what they were doing. They were, again, to a man and woman, very appreciative.
Have you heard any reaction?
Yes, I have. I send copies of the book to every soldier that I interviewed and photographed, including the ones that unfortunately had to be cut, and I have heard back from some. Just recently, in fact, a few days ago, I got an email from one of the soldiers in the book who's now in Afghanistan and was home on leave and had asked me to send the book to his family. And he said he finally had a chance to read it. But what struck me the most and was incredibly gratifying was he said his father had read it. And his father said to him, you know, now I understand why you chose this profession, and I see that you're not wasting your time. And that's exactly the intent of this book. So that was very gratifying.
How did you approach the Army about this project?
I was first put in touch. I asked around for a year or so anybody that I knew, if they knew any returning veterans who might be willing to speak with me or be photographed. I was subsequently put in touch with then Lieutenant Colonel, now Colonel Kathy Platone, who's the first subject in the book. She had just returned from deployment and was very enthusiastic about the idea and said, you know, I was embedded with this particular battalion. I think there are some people here who would be really interested in speaking with you. You know, why don't you come down to Fort Benning and visit? So with that in hand, I then approached the Army's Central Public Relations office in New York and wrote up a proposal describing what I wanted to do, and got a sort of not terribly encouraging form email back and figured this was a no-go, but sort of waited and waited and waited, and maybe 3 months later got another email saying your project's been approved. So just wended its way through the bureaucracy. So then with that in hand, I went to Fort Benning and met with Kathy, and then she made the rounds with me to the local commanders, because even with the Army's approval, one really needs the backing of the unit leadership, and explained to them what I wanted to do. And they were all very supportive, to the extent that, as I said in the book, no one ever asked to look at my photos, to read any of the transcripts, to sit in at the interviews. They said, go where you want, do what you want. Let us know how we can help you.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, photographer Barry Goldstein. He is the author of Gray Land, Soldiers on War. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon. Join our discussion with a telephone call. I invite your questions and comments. 333-9455 is the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number is 800-222-9455. 800-222-9455. WILL. Well, tell us something about Lieutenant Colonel Kathy Platone.
Kathy is a pistol. So Kathy Platone is a combat stress specialist. She's a psychologist by training. and then served in the active military for several decades. And when I got to know her, or first met her, she had just returned from OIF-3, Operation Iraqi Freedom 3, which is the third year of the war. Kathy was one of the very few combat psychologists whose role it is to help counsel troops and treat them for stress and so on, which, if you can imagine, in a war zone is a very demanding profession. But she's one of the very few psychologists who would venture outside the wire, as they say, that is, outside the safety of the bases, and in fact was embedded with the unit that I followed, the 269 Combined Armored Battalion, which, as you mentioned, is part of the 3rd Brigade Combat Team. And the 269, during the second part of this OIF-3 deployment, was stationed in one of the most violent places then in Iraq, which was Ramadi. And Kathy spent a number of months there with the soldiers. Now, understand, she was at the time about 54 years old. She's probably, 5 feet tall, weighs, 90 pounds, soaking wet. So she carried almost her body weight in armor and weaponry. And she would treat these soldiers and counsel them even under fire. And as I say in the book, as one grizzled NCO said to me, Grandma came into the mouth of the dragon and pissed fire. Mm-hmm. And so the soldiers really trusted her. And she vouched for me and was really my entree into the battalion. As an aside, she's now back in Iraq, just started her third deployment. She's also been very outspoken about the Army's handling of PTSD in the media. Despite that, she was finally promoted to full colonel, as she says, 6 times a charm. And she's back with doing what she loves.
Yeah, now this is really interesting because in a note at the end of her story here in the book, you say you report on returning to Fort Benning, Lieutenant Colonel Platone continued to care for soldiers voluntarily while waiting 5 months for the Army to approve treatment of a chronic medical problem. Her treatment was denied and she was discharged from active duty.
Yes. When Kathy returned from this deployment, she was waiting for discharge from active duty to return to reserve status. She could have discharged sooner, but was waiting to hear whether a particular medical problem she had would be covered by the Army. During this time, she was at Fort Benning, and although this wasn't required of her, she continued to treat the soldiers that she had started treating in Ramadi, now back in the States, some of whom were suffering from quite severe PTSD. But she's very much able to sort of separate the bureaucratic trials that I think anyone in a large organization is subject to in the bureaucracy of the Army from the soldiers themselves who, as she says, I love these guys mm-hmm. and women.
Yeah. Who takes care of people like Kathy Platone?
That's a good question. I think Kathy is blessed with a loving husband and many friends, and I think very supportive colleagues. And I think ultimately, the Army, it itself also finally came through to some degree. But you know, Kathy is one of the people for whom I tried to write this book, to give people an idea of just what sacrifices our soldiers make. And this doesn't mean that all of our soldiers are flag-waving automata. They're all very different people, and they all have very different opinions about things. Although I should take that back, actually. They probably are all flag-waving, and rightly so. But, even when they are not treated perhaps as well as they could be, they still love the country. They are in this for the service. Love their brothers and sisters, and again, to almost a man and woman, it's sort of why they do this.
Mm. How would you describe the portrait of Kathy Platone?
Well, I'll tell you, it's not her favorite picture of herself. she looks like she's been to war and back, and that was deliberate. I wanted to photograph her as I saw her, so I didn't employ, as with any of these images, any of the particular tricks of photography to try to flatter people. So she has she's engaging the viewer with a very direct gaze and a very intense look, and she does look a little bit beat.
Mm. She also looks, though, like she's still got some fight in her.
Kathy always Kathy will put her in her grave kicking and screaming.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, she definitely did.
What were these portrait sessions like? Because, as you said, each story in the book is a very individual story. Mm-hmm. These are individuals.
Sure.
And they're so different.
Well, generally what I tried to do was interview people first. And even though the interviews might last an hour or significantly longer, I would ask relatively few questions. Tell me something about your background. Tell me why you joined the military. Share with me any experiences you'd care to share about your deployment or the period after. And if you had a message that you could deliver to the American people or people like me who are pretty ignorant of the military, what would it be? But that was enough to get people started. So by the time we actually got to the photographic session, I knew a fair bit about them, and they knew something about me. Then, as I tell all my subjects in portrait photography, I say I only need a small percentage of your attention. So feel free to let your mind go elsewhere and just be slightly aware I may direct you to look this way or that. But otherwise, don't worry about smiling or standing in a certain way. And many of the soldiers were then able to just sort of absent themselves. Occasionally, I would ask people I would say, based on the interview, look, I'm going to ask you to do something a little bit painful. I want you to think about that time you described when something bad happened, and that's all you need to do. And so sometimes I would do that. So it was a generally pretty simple arrangement. And technically, I use a fairly simple setup, so that I could do it either in an office at Fort Benning or in Iraq.
Mm.
Many of these formal portraits were actually taken in Iraq.
Mm. There are a couple of fellows in the book photographed together standing by a tank. And I think these are probably a couple of the younger soldiers in the book, Christopher Holmes and Kenneth Hatch.
Yes.
Christopher Holmes is a sergeant. He's a gunner. And Kenneth Hatch is a specialist and a driver. Hatch is 22, Holmes 23. They're so young, yet they are so, they've grown up really fast here.
Yes, they were involved in both OIF 1, the first year of the war, and OIF 3, the third year. And these were two very different different engagements. The first year, the 269, was part of this so-called March to Baghdad, which was essentially a large armored and troop movement towards the capital. And as you mentioned, they're both both involved in operating a tank. And so what that period was like for them was certainly part of, and as they describe, had a certain degree of elation to it. It was, of course, very trying. They were operating almost around the clock, but covering large distances in with their tank company, covering a lot of ground. And so in a sense, although I certainly don't want to minimize this, but it was to some degree, at least for a little while, sort of fit their preconceptions of what war would be like, although they saw many terrible things. Once they got to Baghdad, that changed. They weren't moving around quite so much, and they saw a lot of other really unpleasant things, particularly the degree of death and destruction on the highways surrounding Baghdad, because the weaponry of the American armor was just so vastly superior to anything the Iraqis had. And I think that elation sort of wore off, as is often the case when you're mm-hmm. operating on adrenaline. There's always this letdown. And then, of course, they returned, and this time to a very different type of conflict, one where they weren't maneuvering in a very powerful vehicle, but were more subject to mortar fire and small arms fire and IEDs and the particular stresses with that. So they talked very eloquently about this and how initially when they joined because of the video, meaning this video, recruitment video, the Army uses for armor showing a tank jumping a ditch at high speed. But by the end of their experience, they understood better than the vast majority of us that this was not a game. There was nothing fun about this.
Yeah. On the way into Baghdad, Sergeant Holmes said this van came by, and it was filled from top to bottom full of bodies, and there was about 100 people walking behind it, mourning, and he felt so bad.
Yeah, I think they, as all these soldiers do, they, again, are trained to operate in these conditions and to deal with them, and they perform these missions superbly. The problem is the aftermath. And that tends to be very idiosyncratic, when you sort of see the results of all this. And it's not that they regret it, because this is what they were trained to do, and this is where they were sent, and this is what they were required to do. But, as you said, you grow up very quickly when you see the consequences of these actions. And how people deal with them is very idiosyncratic.
I think we need to talk about the losses of the casualties
mm-hmm.
and what toll that takes on people. And here I've opened the book to Thomas Taylor's story, mm-hmm. Staff Sergeant, age 33, Bayonet Company. He talks about a fellow by the name of Sergeant Saley.
Mm-hmm.
Was a hell of a man. I looked up to that man. His family life to me, that was his life, his wife, Dee Dee, and their three kids. As a matter of fact, our platoon guide was Fat Baby, named after his little boy. When you see somebody and you say, damn, I want to be just like him, that was Sergeant Saley. A couple of questions here. Here we get a sense of the connections between soldiers, but also we get a sense of leadership. What do these soldiers that you talked with, what kind of understanding did you gain from them in terms of what makes a soldier a leader?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, many things, but in terms of the losses and when a soldier is lost, it's not that the leader doesn't mourn or isn't affected. Far from it. There are numerous examples in the book of officers talking about losing men and how they how they're affected by this. You know, the bonds between these soldiers, whether you know officers and their men, the men themselves, is again, as many of the soldiers say, is really closer than those between members of a family. You hear this time and again. They'll talk about, you know, my brother, my sister. So when there's a loss, it's taken very hard, and leaders can take it even harder because in addition to the grief that they feel, there's also a real sense of responsibility because there's not a leader who's worth their salt who doesn't question their activities that led up to this loss. Could I have done something better? Could I have done something different? Could I have deployed my soldiers in a different way? Is there something I could have done to foresee this? So you have the grief over the loss. You have the guilt over the responsibility. Now, in civilian life, if any of us suffers one of these types of losses, you know, what do? We take a week or two off from work. We surround ourselves by our support network, our family, our friends. We take some time to grieve and pull ourselves together. These folks don't have that luxury. They've got to be back on the saddle, you know, the next day, if not that day. And that's what, again, you'll hear these leaders say time and again, I am grieving over the loss of this soldier, but I've got 70 or 80 other soldiers who are now depending on me, and I can't let them down. I can't let them see me, let them see that this has affected my ability to lead them and to keep them safe and to accomplish this mission. And so they've really got to defer any grieving process that they have and, you know, and just simply carry on. And how they do this is, to me, unimaginable. But it's certainly, you know, one of the requirements of leadership in a war zone.
Yeah. Now, also, Staff Sergeant Taylor was wounded in the IED incident that killed Sergeant Saley, and you know, at the end of the day, he'd like to go back. That's
yes. You also hear this very frequently that wounded soldiers, the first thing they want to do is go back. Many feel that they. Whereas some of us might feel, okay, we did our duty and we paid the price, many of them often feel, I let down my colleagues because I had to leave the fight. I left them back there to continue to have to do all of this while, you know, I'm at home. And so, yes, he very much wanted to go back.
Yeah.
And in fact, Staff Sergeant Taylor, even though he has some disability, has chosen to stay in the Army. They have what they call the Wounded Warriors Program, where they try to keep these folks and you know, find useful jobs for them.
We have about a minute left here, Barry. By way of summing up, anything you'd like to say?
I think, first of all, thanks for having me and giving me the chance to reach some of your listening public. I would just like people to think some about what being a soldier entails. And this is beyond putting a magnet on a car or sending a care package, although those things are certainly welcome and that level of support. Understand that this is a demanding profession, and I mean that in both parts of both senses. It's the physical demands are probably obvious and the ones we tend to focus on, although they are extreme, but also the psychological and emotional demands of operating in a war zone. But also that it's a profession. You know, in the civilian world, we sometimes tend to think that because what we do is complicated, everything else must be easier, and that couldn't be less true about being in the military. These folks have to deal with extremely complex systems. As you mentioned, they have to be very flexible and, you know, undergo a lot of planning. And so think about that. Think of these folks as professionals, not necessarily heroes, although certainly to some, not in their own minds, but to many they are, and that's fine. But don't stop there. You know, appreciate what it takes to be part of this profession. Mm.
Well, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon, and thanks for the book telling these stories of these soldiers.
Oh, it was my pleasure.
Barry Goldstein is the author of Gray Land, Soldiers on War. The book is published by W.W. Norton. And that interview was conducted on January 15th of this year. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks so much for tuning in today. It is 1:53. Settlement prices should be in from Kansas City and Chicago. Here with those numbers, I believe, today, Todd Gleason.
Thank you very much. Okay. That is correct, Celeste. And Chicago futures finished the day like this. They were higher. Nearby contract in the wheat pit was up 7.75 cents for the May at 489 on its top side. The bottom on a range down to $4.79 and a half. That's what, just about a 9.5 cent trading range with a settlement price at 487, up close to the top inside of that at 7.75 cents higher for the soft red May winter wheat. July futures, 501 and three quarters the top, the bottom at 449 and a half, the settlement price at $4.99 and three quarters, up 7.75 cents in September, 516 and three quarters the high, the low at 508, settled 515 and three quarters, up 8 and one quarter for the hard red winter wheat traded in Kansas City. The settlement price today at 505 and a half, up 7 cents. Corn pit now, May futures 366 and three quarters was the settlement price, up 3.5 cents, the high at 68 and three quarters, the low at $3.64 and three quarters. May corn again settled at $3.66 and three quarters, finished the day 3.5 cents higher. The next contract, July futures at 380 top, bottom at 374 and a half, settled 377 and three quarters, up 3.5. And September corn, $3.89 the high, the low at 83 and a half, settlement price at 387 and a quarter, up 3.5 cents. September contract was 3.5 higher for the day. Now the December futures, 398 and a half the high, the low at 393. Settlement price $3.96 and three quarters, up 3 and three quarters. That's the December harvest month. And the March contract for next year, 410 the high, the low at $4.05. Settled at 408 and a quarter, up 4 cents. May oat futures up 2 at 218. July 226 and a half, 1 and three quarters higher. Soy complex, May beans, $9.45, the settlement price. The high at 48, the low at 30.5. Settlement again at $9.45. The gain today, 15 cents in the May soybeans. July futures, 9.55.5, the high. The low there at 9.37.75. Settlement price at 9.52.75, up 15.25. The August, 9.51.75, the high. The low at 35.75. Settlement price at 9.50.25, up 14.75. September futures, 9.37.25, the high. The low at 9.23.25, settlement price at 9.35.75, up 14.25, and November beans 9.29.25, the high, the low at 12.5, settlement price at $9.26, up 12 cents. January futures 9.37.75, the high, the low at 23.5, settlement price at 9.35.25 in the bean pit, up 11.75 for the January soybeans. May bean meal futures a 2.61.50, settlement price up $3.90, 63.60 was the top, 57.10 the bottom. Soybean oil futures 39.46, the high, the low at 38.80, settled at 39.37, up 62 cents on the afternoon. I'll return at 6 after the hour of 2 o'clock this afternoon. We'll talk with Mike Barwinski about the energy and ethanol markets, and we'll talk with Wayne Nelson of L&M Commodities about the commodity markets, all at 6 after the hour of 2 o'clock, just a bit less than 10 minutes away now. I'm Todd Gleason.
Agricultural programs are made possible by First Midwest Bank, serving Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and McHenry. More information is available from Sarah Lukacs in Morris at 815-941-3709. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
Now we move on to the livestock contracts. April live cattle, the high today 95.80, the low 95.20, the settlement 95.47.5, down 17.5. June 93.80, the high 93.35, the low 93.62.5, the settlement up 2.5. August 91.35, the high 90.80, the low 91.15, the settlement up 17.5. October 93.30, the high, the low 92.75, the settlement 93.22.5, up a nickel. March feeder cattle 103.20, the high 102.90, the low 102.95, the settlement up a nickel. April 106.15, the high 105.65, the low 105.85, the settlement down 17.5. May 107.45, the high 106.97.5, the low, the settlement 107 even, down 37.5. August 109 even, the high 108.55, the low 108.80, the settlement down 32.5. April lean hog 72.20, the high 71 even, the low 71.75, the settlement down 5. May 78.20, the high 76.70, the low, the settlement 78.17.5, up 60. June 81.60, the high 80 even, the low 81.10, the settlement up 52.5. July 81.65, the high 80 even, the low 81.50, the settlement up 97.5. May pork bellies 91.50, the high 90.40, the low 91.05, the settlement unchanged. And let's take a quick peek at Wall Street. The Dow currently up 18 at 10,651. The NASDAQ is up 11 at 2369. The S&P 500 7 higher at 1157. Nearby crude up 192 to make that 191 to 8171 a barrel. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL, 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD2 and HD3 Urbana, online at will.illinois.edu. We are broadcasting from Campbell Hall for public telecommunication, thanks to the generosity of University of Illinois alumni Alice and Robert Campbell. Coming up on 2 o'clock, 59 degrees in Urbana on the campus of the University of Illinois. Ed Kieser's forecast for Illinois and Indiana this afternoon. In northwestern and west central Illinois and in far southern Illinois, mostly cloudy. Elsewhere, mostly sunny. Highs generally ranging from 47 in west central Illinois to 62 in north central Illinois. Tonight in west central and southwestern Illinois, mostly cloudy. Elsewhere, partly cloudy. Lows tonight ranging from 30 in northeastern Indiana to 40 in west central and southern Illinois. The outlook for tomorrow in west central and southern Illinois and